happens. And I've spent most of my academic career trying to explicate those kinds of questions in different kinds of empirical settings. I was lucky in a number of ways. And all of you will be lucky in almost anything that happens. And so so it's important to recognize that contingency really does play a hugely important role in where you get jobs, when you get jobs there, and no matter how well you try and structure yourself into the kinds of boxes that you're told will put you on a causal pathway towards a good job, contingency intervenes. I went to Columbia during a period of great disciplinary flux at the end of the 1970s and beginning of the 1980s, and this was very lucky for me. It meant that I was not required to put myself in a methodological box. In fact, it would have been hard to do so at Columbia at that time. And therefore, it was possible to bring this kind of eclectic, historical, theoretical, political, sociological set of approaches to bear on the kinds of questions that I worked on, which started out with my dissertation being a study of the formation of the Workers' Party in Brazil, and then moved through a long period of working on environmental politics, and now has a lot to do with the relationship between formal and informal in institutional change within and outside of the state. So I'm going to sort of cut to the last part and talk about three things that I think, although I'm not sure, may be fundamental to interpretive research, and none of them is easily described. I've been thinking very, very hard about this over the last week because the question of how I go about doing my research is not something that I had ever tried to organize cogently in one place before. The three things are essentially can be sort of defined as follows. They include a habit of mind, a passion for politics, and a deep reflexivity. These are all connected, but I'm going to try and talk about them separately. The habit of mind includes a disposition to stand outside of your own situation and to try as far as you can to see out of someone else's eyes. And along with that, you have to know in advance that there's probably another way of seeing besides your own. Along with this comes a willingness to accept that what you believe to be the set of ordering principles may be only one among many such sets, whose interaction may produce something that you don't immediately understand. Be skeptical of your efforts to sort of impose order prematurely on something that you don't know very much about. You have to accept prolonged uncertainty and messiness and resist the temptation to impose artificial order on something just because you have a deadline. There are usually other ways of formulating the paper. Well, almost always. If you really need to have all of the T's crossed and the I's dotted, then you ought to be choosing another approach to doing research. I think that the second requirement, if you're going to do good empirical interpretive research, at least, is a passion for politics. Obviously, there are a great many people who use other methodologies who share this passion, and that's a good thing because it makes it a lot easier to talk to them than it would be otherwise. But with interpretive research, you're kind of working without a net. You can't make it through on the basis of mastery of tools alone. You have to have something to say. You have to cultivate a well-honed sensibility to the workings of power. You have to understand what it means both to revel in it and to rail against it and even to use it. The third requirement is attentiveness to reflexivity, and here I'm going to repeat some of the stuff that came out in the conversation between Aida and Nora earlier. Because the particular form of reflexivity that interpretive work involves places very high demands on the researcher. Reflexivity is a constant in interpretive work. You are part of the story once you begin to ask people to explain it to you, or even when you make the decision to ask them in the first place. Your experience frames the choices that you make about what you ask and the words that you use when you do the asking. And the same experience calls from and is also... Whoops, all right, I'm out of time. And the same experience calls from and is also transformed by what those who you're talking to are saying. This gives interpretive research some of its greatest power and is also the source of its greatest peril. Interpretation is always a balancing act in which your understanding of what you're studying is always formed in dialogue with your experience, and the process of studying it will change you, but you have to resist the temptation to turn that dialogue into a monologue by seeing your own reflection at every turn in what you're looking at. You have to fight as hard as you can against the part of you that responds instinctively, "Yes, I know what you mean. I understand what you're feeling. I see what you're saying." Particularly when you're studying people and processes that you find sympathetic, and I am often doing that, the desire to identify with them is very, very strong. You instinctively draw from your own reservoir of meaning something that resonates with what they're saying. That makes it familiar. That makes it yours. That makes you feel part of it. Be careful, because this is one of the most risky moments in interpretive research. It's the most misleading moment. The moment when by absorbing the thing that you are investigating into your own experience, you potentially fail to recognize the very different meanings that the experiences of the participants may be giving it. You stop seeing and hearing, and the worst of it is that this is probably the moment where you most euphorically feel that you've really gotten it, that you really understand. You're happy. This is where you can lose your way, and we have all done it, and I've done it more than once. But you can recover. You don't have to do that. There are ways out of it. One way to avoid it is to know that it's going to happen. Another way to avoid it is to keep shifting the lens of the discussion and trying to broaden the conversation, trying to situate what you're looking at in a variety of different theoretical contexts, and try and understand it in a variety of ways. And here's one place where things like literature and other ways of trying to get into, either get into the heads of people whose experience is very different from your own, or at least recognize how different their experience may be from your own, even if you can't reproduce an understanding of what that feels like. Is an important way of doing it. And there are lots of techniques, and anthropologists have written a lot about this because this is normally their bailiwick rather than the bailiwick of political scientists. But insofar as interpretive research becomes accepted in political science, and insofar as we make ourselves legitimate by telling compelling stories and relating those stories in ways that people can theoretically grasp to the big questions and the big debates of both our discipline and the world, not necessarily in that order, then we have to be very careful about some of the dangers that come with using this kind of methodology and try and work hard on doing it really well. I said at the beginning that I didn't have a way of ending this, and so that being still true, I will simply stop and see whether questions can help.